All right, folks, welcome. This is episode 23, maybe 24.
24.
I said just before we went live, I was like, I need my cheat sheet. And then I opened the cheat sheet, which I normally, oh, actually, it does. It says it right in the title. It's episode 23. There we go.
Okay.
So as usual, I'm Brett.
And I'm Travers.
And this is another episode of Talking Cloud, where we discuss some interesting AWS updates and interesting Gen AI news from the last week or so.
Roughly. I've got a few older items, but I wasn't here last week. So.
Oh yeah, I flew solo last week. Yeah. That was weird.
How did that go?
It was like lightning round. Because there was no banter, right? Karen laughed at me. She's like, are you done already? I said, yeah, Travers isn't feeling well, so it's just me. So I just kind of, it would be really weird if I tried to establish banter with myself. That would be strange.
That would be a very interesting podcasting experience.
Yeah. Once you start talking to yourself on the podcast, maybe you'd get more listeners, viewers, because they're like, who's this weird person talking to themselves? But I don't know. Who knows? All right, let's jump in. Segment one is always, I was going to say cloud formation. I'm looking at the screen. Segment one is always sort of the interesting AWS news updates that we got from last week. So I always like when I see cloud formation because we spend so much of our time in cloud formation. So here's another sort of quality of life update, streamlining deployment troubleshooting with CloudTrail integration. So if you remember, I don't know, let's say a couple months ago, they introduced the detect root cause button. So if your stack deployment or your stack update failed, you could click that and it would at least highlight the event in the stack that they assumed caused the overall stack update or creation to fail. So you could at least highlight it. And now you can still click the detect root cause button, but then you can go off to the CloudTrail event dashboard and actually see the API information that they believe might have caused the problem. So that's good.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome. So does it pull you directly to the CloudTrail event that they think is associated?
Yes. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. You know, I'd say that I purposely made a CloudFormation template not work to see how this worked, but it didn't take long for me to actually go, hey, wait, I'll click this button. I had done the detect root cause thing before, and to be honest,
it's okay.
You took me to the specific event, which is better than me having to scroll through and look, but now also being able to, instead of having to try to go and find it in CloudTrail, it took me right to the event. That's actually got, I think, some value because you spend a lot of time looking through CloudTrail trying to find what the hell you did wrong, right?
Well, sure. Yeah. And it's not the most searchable tool. Like there's some nuances to trying to find what exactly you're looking for with CloudTrail.
Yeah.
So having a direct link back there that's great.
Yeah. It helped me when I messed that template up on purpose, not on purpose.
Right. You're deliberate.
Yeah, I did it. Yeah. I did it for, it was science. tangent here. You mentioned about sort of, you know, the CloudTrail console, not necessarily super intuitive to search. Any tips that you might give somebody if they're like, how the hell do I find this stuff?
Yeah. So if you're looking, so tip number one, if you're trying to find a failed API call, you should turn on error codes in the view because it's not on by default. You have to enable that. Tip number two, the thing I found the easiest way to troubleshoot some access denied calls, if you're not sure what the actual error is to just download all of the events that are read-only true and read-only false from the window you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And then you can sort that in a CSV reader like Numbers or Excel.
Oh.
And you can search that a lot easier.
Yeah. That's a really good tip. The error column one is what I do all the time. I get rid of a few of the other columns that I don't care about just to make sure on my screen I can quickly see the error column and I just sort of very quickly scroll.
Yeah.
The other thing that I do quite often is I'll try to look for the user that executed it. So I know it's our GitLab role. So I might search for the GitLab role to try to find it that way. to be honest, I'd never thought of the CSV download. That's a really good idea, because to your point, you can search through that way easier in Excel or so whatever, right? Or even if you put it in a text editor, just started searching, it'd probably be better.
For sure. Yeah. You could dump that wherever. Right. Yeah. That's helped me out many times is looking for the event in there, because the user is not necessarily intuitive as to who's making the API calls.
That's something
you got to watch out for.
Yeah.
And if you know the event name, you search for the event name, you sometimes still will come up dry because it might not be necessarily related to the service you're thinking of. Yeah. Like KMS and S3 is an example that comes to mind.
KMS, right? KMS is the worst.
Right, because it never tells you it's KMS.
No.
It never tells you it's an encryption issue. But
usually you've gone through every other thing that you can possibly think of, and then you're like, wait, I better check KMS. And you go and look at that, and there's the access denied thing that you're like, son of a... Yeah, you just spent an hour looking for other things. You made me think of something, actually, that happened just today. And even, you're mentioning about, like, the user isn't necessarily intuitive. Even if you think you know what the API call is, that's also not necessarily great, because I was doing something today and in my brain, I'm like, I'm creating this thing. But I was searching for that particular API call and it's not there. And I'm like, well, what the hell? So I kept reading and I asked Q, which actually worked out well for me. And it said, oh, what you're doing is an import. And I'm like, oh,
right.
So my brain just immediately thought I was creating something, even though I did ask it to import it. So yeah, you know, sometimes it can get confusing. I like the CSV trick. That's a good one. I guess if you had CloudTrail integrated into sort of like a SIM tool or something like that, like I'll call it a fancier search tool, maybe you could find it easier or more easily
If you're ingesting it in like Splunk or something, you probably have a better time with that. Yeah. But just in the console, you can download a CSV or JSON to parse. So.
Yeah, good tip. Perfect. So there's our first thing. We've got another CloudFormation update. Yeah, so now they have a new parameter for the delete stack API call. And this is a parameter called deletion mode. And as it says in that first paragraph here, it's a new parameter that allows customers to safely delete their CloudFormation stacks that are in delete failed state. Which has happened to me before, right? Because at least in my experience, what's happened is I deploy a VPC. Let's use VPC as an example, right? I deploy a VPC, and somewhere along the line, somebody creates a security group or something, not through CloudFormation. It's associated with the VPC, and I'm trying to clean up, and I get a delete failed state. So this is a way that you could... safely delete those CloudFormation stacks that are essentially in a stuck state, right? I kind of think of it that way. So, yeah, and they give you an example here, right? When customers attempt to delete a non-empty S3 bucket, which I've probably done a few times, the delete stack can enter a delete failed state in some scenarios. And then what you can do is pass a forced delete stack value to the deletion mode parameter and delete that stack.
Okay, but it still leaves the failed resources, right?
Yeah, so I almost... Just, oh, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, it's just more like removing a little bit of admin work for cleaning up lingering stacks then.
Yeah. Again, I think this is a good example of sort of the quality of life type things that we often see in sort of non-reinvent season with these updates. Just making your life a little easier. So,
Important to note, the resource will stay there depending on its deletion policy.
Yeah, so the deletion policy is still taken into account, right? Which makes a lot of sense, because you don't want to, you know, it might be saying we can't delete that because this S3 bucket it's got data in it. And that's a nice way to protect yourself. And you still got to go and think about it, right? So couple CloudFormation updates. And we'll change gears here. We'll talk about Bedrock. There's a new Mistral model available. I signed up for it today. I added it to our list. I haven't tried it out yet. I actually used it. I was saying to you before we joined, I just did an intro to Gen AI on AWS webinar, and I did a bunch of demos and stuff in it. And one of the things that threw me when I first started using Bedrock, and it's complete user error, right? If you look at the documentation, it's a big red bubble. It, you know, it yells at you that you must enable the model before you can use the model. And I was like, why the hell isn't this working? Yeah, it is important to actually have access to the model before you try to talk to the model. So I made sure that I pointed that out during the webinar because, well, a lot of times I find that the true value in a lot of technology webinars is somebody else did something stupid, and they can, if they're willing to tell you that they did something stupid, they can save you from your own stupid moves. So yeah, I signed up for this today. I have not tried it yet, but I guess, again, this is another example of how AWS, it seems like their game plan continues to be, let's have the most models possible, because in the end, it's probably going to come down to where can I get access to a model for my specific use case, right?
Yeah, so, and how easy is it to access? And that seems like the game plan.
Yeah, and in this example, when I did the little demo, I clicked request access, clicked the little button, clicked request, and by the time I made it back to the screen, the screen loaded, it said you have access to it. I didn't try it in the demos, but yeah, it's up and running. So there's another one. Nice. We've got another Mistral announcement here, not AWS related at this point, but another model that's available. So that's good.
Looks like, this one's specializing in RAG applications.
RAG. Yeah. You know what would be really good, and maybe AWS has this, is like a little bit of a cheat sheet. Here are all the models and like what, you know, they do this for like EC2 instance types. They're like general purpose is great if you need this, or compute optimized is great if you need this.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a it'd be nice to have a little cheat sheet for this so you can kind of maybe it exists.
Yeah. Tags you could filter on in the screen maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's Mistral, another model that you can add. And then finally, this one just caught my attention because of some work we've done in the past, right, with customers with the network firewall. I didn't realize that the default limit was 30,000 stateful rules per firewall policy in a region, but you can now increase that up to 50,000. So basically... Okay. More processing power is kind of the way that I thought of this, right? More rules that you can put in place to protect your infrastructure.
Pretty much, yeah. It sounds like you can use more firewall capacity, essentially.
Yeah.
So if you're feeling capped at 30,000 rules, then now you got 20,000 more.
Maybe that gives you an indication of the types and sizes of organizations that might be using the network firewall.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Although in fairness, we've used it a couple times. Once in sort of a more of a stressful situation, and once in a more planned out environment. And even in small implementations, like for me, if you've got that nice sort of centralized ingress egress point to all of your VPCs, having that network firewall in that centralized, I'm going to call it internet account, right? Makes a lot of sense because you're filtering all the traffic at that point that's coming into your environment or leaving. So very handy stuff.
It makes a lot of sense in those deploys.
Yeah. So that, let me just check my cheat sheet here. That's all of the things that sort of caught my attention this week. All right. So eventually at some point, I'll create like a little transition screen. So let's change gears. Oh, actually, I lied. There's one more. It's not really an AWS update though. I came across this somewhere, and you know how hard it has been for me for the last week not to try this out on our website. It seems like we use Tailwind right now, sort of the I'll call it a CSS framework. Yeah, right. And I don't know where I found this. It might have been in a Twitter post. It might have been in a webinar that I attended or something. And somebody's like, hey, have you seen this? And it is really a series of layouts using pre-built components. And if I'm understanding it, these are the same components that AWS uses on the management console.
These look exactly like AWS's console UI components. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Is this, do they use Cloudscape? Like, is this the exact thing that they use? They seem to have the same link button there.
Yeah, it looks very similar. I would suspect that they're using this, or maybe they're using like a version of it, a slightly modified version or something on the AWS, like the management console and stuff. But there have been many, many occasions this week where I was like, do not create a branch for the website and start putting this in place because you have other things to do. You know, it's like shiny new toy. I'm going to go play with that instead of doing my work. So yeah. Anyways, what's that?
They released it they created it in 2016 and it looks like they released it. So it is AWS's UI elements.
Yeah. Is it something they just released then? They've been using it since 2016 and just sort of, for lack of a better word, open sourced it at this point?
This announcement was posted on July 19th, 2022. So it's been around 2022, for 2 years. It's been
a while. Yeah. I think I stumbled across it like in a Twitter thread or something. I was just like, what the hell is that? And I went and looked at it. I was like, oh my God.
I think I remember you talking about this when they announced it vaguely. Yeah. You're like, oh, look, we could do this to the website. And then again,
you know, same thing happened. Yeah. Go do something important. Yeah. I might have mentioned it. I don't remember. I don't remember what I ate for lunch, and that was only like 2 hours ago. Yeah, so
fair enough.
Yeah, unless I make a note for myself now, it's gone. So not really an AWS update, but something that I came across this week that I thought was interesting. So let's change gears and talk about Gen AI. This is a weird screen to look at. It is the summit from Los Angeles. Matt, I can't remember if we play it.
This year. 7 days ago. Okay, so this is
last year. It's just recent. Matt Wood, I think, is the presenter's name, and I want to say he's the Gen AI lead for AWS. I've watched this in bits and pieces. I don't know if there was anything in here groundbreaking. I did make a couple things, you know, typical AWS fashion. More than 10,000 customers are using Bedrock. As we mentioned already, and as I mentioned in the webinar earlier today, the broadest set of models available, those kinds of things. So, like I said, I've been sort of consuming this in chunks. I might bring it up over the next couple weeks, just as I find out more interesting stuff here. But I'll definitely make sure this is in the show notes because, well, I'm a bit of a fan of AWS keynotes. I often find, I call it crystal ball gazing, sort of like you get little hints here on maybe the way that they're thinking the industry is moving or the way that they might be moving. So I think these are valuable investments of time, but it is an hour and 20 minutes. So
yeah. I'll have to watch this later. It is a great way to kind of get a glimpse into what they might be planning for various services.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I bet you any money they generated that background on that fancy TV screen there using Gen AI. It looks like a Gen AI background.
It does kind of look like it.
I've got a couple prompts that I stored away in my prompt library that I use to generate backgrounds for slides and stuff now on an quite often basis. So there you go. This one caught my attention. Amazon's, is this, I hope I shared the right one. Yes, this is from 2024.
Yeah.
Amazon has said, now, with a giant caveat here, and I'll tell you why I think there's a caveat to this, that there's an AI, an Alexa. I was making sure my Echo didn't pop to life over here. There is an LLM update coming to make these devices smarter, but it does appear that you will need to add something to your Prime subscription to get access to it. Otherwise, you've got, I'm going to sound harsh, the dumb Echo. And then let's just, for now, I'm going to reserve my enthusiasm and say less dumb Echo that's using an LLM.
Right? We'll see how good it is.
Yeah. So I just caught this because voice has always been a thing. I think both of us had the Alexa certification before they immediately retired it, right?
They discontinued it after one cycle,
basically. Yeah, it was gone pretty quickly. I've always been a huge fan of this. Like I've said that I think voice is maybe the future of computing in a lot of situations, but I don't think it's unfair to say, and I've heard from other people that they feel like they're I'm going to call it an Echo device because I keep pushing my luck here. Excuse me. Their Echo device seems to be getting dumber recently.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, it's like, getting less functional, less useful.
Yeah, like, I don't know how many times I have to, like, repeat myself now. I ask it to play a song and it doesn't do it. I got to ask again. I'm hopeful for this. I will pay for this for a month. I will pay for it for a month. And if it's still as shit, then I'll just go back and save a few bucks. But I don't know when this is actually coming because I put in the notes that Amazon actually announced that there was an LLM coming for this back at their last hardware keynote or whatever you want to call it in 2023. And we still don't have it.
For years, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure.
Probably
I'm
one of the first applications they thought of for LLMs was Alexa.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you think about it, right? What's it called? Amazon Lex has been around for a long time, right? It's one of the very first AI solutions on AWS, or one of the let's say early ones, right? And it was my understanding of that was it was based off of what they had created for the Echo devices. Mm-hmm. So this. You know, they're making a big change here to go from sort of an AI solution to a Gen AI solution using an LLM. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see how the quality is impacted, whether or not it gets more useful or less useful with this update. So
yeah,
I mean, voice technology, it's one of the cool sci-fi holy grail things, right? Like you think of Star Trek, you think of any kind of sci-fi voice interface with a computer. Like HAL 9000, all that stuff.
Yeah. I we'll see. I will subscribe to this the moment it is available in Canada. I think I read somewhere that obviously they're releasing it in the US first. The moment I can get it here, I will sign up for it. And hopefully I will be blown away, but I'll reserve fingers crossed. I'll reserve my enthusiasm until I actually see what it is. So something to keep on your radar. Now this, I like this. This is behind a paywall, but I used one of my share articles to have a look at this. And it caught my attention because we often talk on the show about how AI is going to replace people's jobs. And this article is saying, if an AI can replace you, then it can probably replace the CEO of a company as well. And I liked it just because it's sort of role reversal a little bit. You know, the folks in the companies are the ones that tend to be worried about this. But this article is basically saying that while leadership is important, a lot of these AI tools could, obviously they're not going to provide leadership, but they could, provide guidance and direction in a much more efficient way. In a less, maybe even less biased way than a person might.
Yeah, it's tricky, right? I mean, what does the CEO actually do? It's kind of nebulous to put it down.
Yeah, they say in this article. Yeah, finish your thought. I'm going to scroll through and just read here for a second.
I'm just thinking. You have the leadership perspective, right? Like the, and then you have executive decision making it from the top down, and kind of. North Star policy choices. And I wonder if there's some involvement with maybe interacting with other organizations, companies, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So can you replace that with essentially a Gen AI model?
It appears almost half of executives surveyed, you'll notice right here, do believe that most or all of the chief executive roles could be completely automated or replaced by AI.
So well, that's coming from within.
It's coming from the executive saying, I could be replaced. And then they scroll down. What really got me about this was, you know, now some of this might obviously be because Gen AI is the thing right now, people trying to get a little bit of press and stuff like that. But you can see there's a Chinese online gaming company that has said they're being run by an AI driven CEO named Tang. And then there's another example here, a Polish rum company is also being sort of run by an AI CEO called Micah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder who is running these AIs. What are they running on?
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought, right?
It's just ChatGPT. You just start a new conversation. Tell me how to do this.
Outsourcing your company top level leadership to another company is kind of interesting.
You know, although obviously not on the scale that we're talking on these things, not small consulting shop that we are, but you know, I remember you and I were talking one day and I said about, you know, I think I asked it was ChatGPT. I was like, you know, hey, this is the characteristic of our business. This is what we do. Mm-hmm. Could you help me with sort of a SWOT analysis? There's lots of other things you could do. And I was dumbfounded is too strong of a word, but I was actually shocked at how relevant, I would say like 90% of what it gave back to me as a small AWS consulting shop. Here are the threats, here are your opportunities, right? Even the weaknesses that it gave back to us have been things that we've talked about internally. And if, you know, I don't know. Interesting. So I'll make sure I include this one in the show notes as well, because I thought it was a really good little article about, you know, instead of the folks doing the work being replaced, maybe this is also going to replace the people at the top of the pile too. So interesting.
Well, I could definitely see you could pump the equivalent of an MBA into some sort of RAG augmented system and get it to help you almost act like a consulting CEO on your corporate policy, right?
A fractional CEO.
There
when you need it kind of thing. And to your point about sort of RAGs, and think about in a larger organization, all of the memos, all of the emails, strategy documents that they already have that you could feed into this thing for additional context.
So that's kind of compelling. So if you could have, you could pump in your entire organization's text ecosystem, email ecosystem, and give that as context. So it has maybe even a better picture of what's really going on in the system than your average human CEO would. I mean, probably the best case is to have both, right? You want to augment your human CEO with these kind of systems.
Yeah.
But if you can't afford a... $10 million Fortune 500 CEO.
Then you've got this, right? Yeah. And when you think, just because, you know, I did the webinar piece, you know, we talk about Q business in there, and you know, I think of Q business. So we've talked a lot about sort of this idea of knowledge bases and augmenting your model with specific information that you know that relates to your business, right? And Q business, I think, makes it even easier because it's a higher level of abstraction that you don't necessarily have to think about all of the underlying bits and pieces that you might be concerned about with Bedrock, which is already a level of abstraction, right? And you think about all of the connectors that already exist for Q business. You could tie it to Slack. You could tie it to Jira. You could tie it to your website. There's like, I think I counted for the webinar, and I want to say there were just under 40 or just over 40 connectors. And is pulling in all of that contextual information that you could then ask your AI assistant that you've built in Q business, tell me about something, right? And it's going to go off and pull all that information together. So I think this will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah. One thing I'd be worried about for CEO specifically is identifying new threats or opportunities.
Yeah.
That might be an issue with these kind of systems. So you want to think about that, but yeah, really.
But to your point, that's where you kind of, you have your AI CEO doing all the grunt work kind of thing. And the human that's augmenting that is the person that's thinking about, or the team that's thinking about what's coming down the pipe that this AI doesn't know about yet. Right. Cause there's not enough info out there. So yeah, I think your point about augmenting this with a human or a team is obviously still very important. I just like these articles. I think it's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out. Okay, so that's that. Not only are blue-collar workers and white-collar workers getting replaced, but now the CEO as well. And here's a common theme that we often talk about on the show, and it's the AI chip wars here. And Gartner is saying that they expect AI chips revenue to grow by 33% in 2024. And I think you'll see here sort of revenue estimations out to 2025 of what, this is in millions of dollars. So that would be what, 91
billion? $2 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. Going from 53 billion just 2 years before it. So yeah, I don't really know what else to say about, oh, the one thing that grabbed me here was this. Gartner forecasts AI PC shipments will reach 22% of the shipments, PC shipments in 2024. And then by the end of 2026, 100% of enterprise PC purchases will be an AI PC, meaning they have the processing that they need. Yeah, right in the device, so it's running all the time.
But we just saw Apple release their new iPad that has the AI chip, and they're releasing that in all future models, I'm sure, of their MacBooks.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's only a matter of time, right? Even consumer grade stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's the only kind of chip where you're not affected by shrinkflation. So you got that going for you.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, you mentioned at the start of the show, you weren't here last week, but we talked about Windows Recall, the new feature in Windows 11, which is requiring a specific chip, right? I think it was a Qualcomm Snapdragon is sort of the chip that they're supporting right now. So you're already seeing it in consumer products as well. So it's, I'm not surprised here. They expect in very short order that all of the enterprise purchases will have this as well.
Phones too. Like that's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's already, I mean, Pixel already has their Google Tensor units, right? So
And then, you know, again, a common theme that we've talked about on the show before is the battle that is coming or is probably already happening that we don't see a lot in tech news at this point, because Nvidia sort of, I think, you know, sucks all the oxygen out of the room for GPUs right now. Right. But AWS, Google, Meta, Microsoft, they all obviously don't want to rely on a different vendor for this stuff. So I can only imagine what it might look like in a couple of years as those larger tech companies catch up, because they're going to catch up, right?
They will. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I saw that was interesting was Intel is actually building Nvidia's CPUs. They're coming up with a CPU, and Intel's building or giving them the silicon to do it.
Really?
Just kind of interesting. Yeah, I know. It's kind of a strange, sounds like a strange business choice, but I guess probably makes sense.
Well, I guess when you control the market like Nvidia does right now, that makes for, what's the saying, odd bedfellows. So maybe Intel's just like, hey, you know, the devil we know, the devil we don't kind of thing. And what are you going to do? So maybe it's, I don't know. You should find that article, or let's dig into that a little bit more, because I'd be interested in reading more about that. It's a strange partnership, but not necessarily surprising.
Yeah, it might be just because they might be giving them their old architecture.
Maybe, yeah.
People are moving more towards ARM now. But
yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. So that's our ongoing chip wars. Here's the other Mistral that I mentioned. So Codastrel.
Oh, okay.
So Codastrel. This is an open model, an open weight generative AI model designed for code generation tasks.
Okay.
Yeah, I just stumbled across this last night when I should have been making slides and I was procrastinating. I went outside to do some gardening, and Karen's like, I was giving you a half an hour and then I was going to come find you, because I knew at that point you're literally just procrastinating and staying outside instead of making slides. So I came across this last night, and some of the modeling here, or the performance, you can kind of see where it sits here. Codastrel 22B at the top. Context is quite large, right, compared to some other ones. It looks pretty interesting. And they say here it's open weighted and you can download it, right? You can download and test it.
Interesting. So, I wonder through Hugging Face. We have it benchmarked against here.
Here, let me scroll back up.
They've got it outperforming.
You want to see this one?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
So, okay. So it seems to be outperforming Code Llama, DeepSeek 33B, and Llama 370B. Okay. So it's kind of in that tier of models. I'd be curious to see how it stacks up against like GPT-4.
Yeah. Or, you know, there's been, I was trying to find the article. last week or the week before, Amazon was sharing a lot of model performance for Q developer as well, saying this is the best Gen AI assistant for code development. And they had little charts like this too. I couldn't find a reference anywhere to where that was coming from, so I haven't included it in the show at all. But I'd like to also see how this stacks up against Q developer.
Yeah, we have to see if they're in the Hugging Face rankings in the arena.
Yeah,
that'd be more telling.
Yeah, and the thing that go ahead.
Pretty heavily incentivized to release good looking.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Tweak it just a little this way so that number goes up a little. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, get it right. I think the thing that jumped out at me was the context, like significantly larger than the ones that they're comparing themselves to. Competing. Obviously, you can pick and choose what they want to show here, but kind of interesting, and you can download it, so might be something interesting to try out. I don't think there was anything else in here that sort of jumped out at me that we should chat about. So there's that. This is an interesting... Oops. I think we lost Travers. We'll see if he joins us back again. But while we're waiting... Oh, there he is. Hey, you're back.
Hey, there we go.
I just started to talk about this article, Fast Company. Here are the companies OpenAI has made deals with to train ChatGPT. And
big business.
I could imagine that there are, this talks about, let's see here, where is it?
Yeah, there's a lot of cash to be had because just to have access to this data is so valuable for these companies.
Yeah, yeah. Geez, I can't remember. Oh, okay. Associated Press, Atlantic, Axel, Springer. There's a bunch of things in here. I would suspect that this will be the standard going forward, that OpenAI and other organizations will start having to license this stuff, pay for this stuff. So maybe OpenAI is trying to get ahead of it to set sort of the prices of this stuff rather than having somebody else set them. I don't know.
Could be. Yeah, maybe I wonder if there's a meta of locking down exclusive data deals.
Maybe.
Too.
Maybe.
Because that's one way you could probably differentiate.
Yeah.
Who did Google... Did Google buy the license to Reddit's data?
I don't know. But it does say in here, the company recently signed a similar deal with Reddit to incorporate its content into ChatGPT and its new products.
So it was OpenAI. They did buy them.
Although, you know what? Like, some of the stuff I read in Reddit, do you really want to train your tool on some of the... Well, I know Google. I don't have an article for this, but I know Google's not had a great week and a half, right? As they integrated into their search and, you know, recommended certain amount of eating rocks and putting
hilarious
glue
results,
on your pizza or something. Like,
God, I really need to get my cheese to stick to my pizza better.
Use a little glue. So obviously there's lots of work still here to do.
It would work.
Technically
it would work.
Technically. Yeah. And you know what? I think most glues nowadays are kids safe and people safe for lots of reason. I bet you if we could go back in time and ask our moms, we've probably eaten a fair amount of glue ourselves while we were wee lads. So
make sure it's Elmer's.
It's kid friendly. Use kid friendly glue. Yeah. So sorry, we got off track a little bit, but yeah, I think these I think these deals are going to start coming, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Google's in talks with Reddit to license.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they were in February anyways.
Yeah. Don't you think that some of this maybe is a little bit of look, we're doing the right thing? Because obviously we don't know, but I wouldn't be shocked if some of these companies have already crawled all this data anyways, and now it's a little bit of PR to make it look a little better than just gobbling up all the world's info for free.
I would bet that they have up to, you know, 2022 or 2020 for all of these sites, and this licensing deal will cover them legally for all of the new data that gets generated. That's my guess.
Yeah, I would suspect you're probably correct on that, right? Little PR, little bit of CYA into the future. But we already got all the data that you've ever had in existence up until 6 months ago, and now we're going to play nice, right? Yeah. So there's that. Interesting article. Okay, so these are a couple that you added as I was doing the webinar. So walk us through these ones. I didn't get a chance to kind of quickly catch up. So what are we talking about?
So these are kind of more nitty gritty on how these Gen AI models, these large language models, work. I was doing some reading while I was out, and okay, so this article is from Anthropic, and it's called Scaling Monosemanticity, Extracting Interpretable Features from Cloud 3 Sonnet. And it's a pretty meaty article, but the gist of it is, like in human brains, in LLMs, each individual neuron isn't associated with one particular thing or concept. The concepts emerge from kind of aggregate firing of groups of them, right? So you have this group of neurons that fire, and you can associate that with abstract concepts. So in this article, they're talking about they found the group of neurons that fires when you're talking about a software bug. I think that's for example.
Yeah, that to me is it's like what they've been trying to do with the human brain for years, right? Like mapping it to understand. Like I always remember that. Remember those old commercials they're starting to bring back? Like the Canadian history things, and there's like that one where they're operating on the person and they're like, I smell burnt toast. Like they're mapping sort of what's happening in the brain. It's sort of, again, I haven't read this, but it seems like they're doing the same thing for LLMs here. Try to figure it out.
It seems like Anthropic is like on the pulse of how these models are, like, they're probably the closest to figuring out how exactly these systems work, or have the most visibility anyways. Mm-hmm. So what's kind of interesting is what you can do is you can dial up the response of some of these patterns, some of these group activations, right? So what they did was they dialed up the pattern for Golden Gate Bridge. Well, they did a control group test, right? First, they said, who are you? What do you do? What are your thoughts on X and Y? And it's an answer that, like you would expect, I'm a machine learning model, etc. If you dial up the Golden Gate Bridge, it tells you it's the Golden Gate Bridge. So you can do this with any kind of abstract feature too, right? So I think they did something where they dialed up some negative patterns like racism and self-loathing, and they made the model get into a loop of hating itself, or at least outputting text that was offensive and hated itself. So you can control how the model interacts with the world or interacts with text by dialing up or dialing down these activations.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I think I might have heard something about this. Like I heard or read a bit of news about somebody being kind of close to understanding how LLMs work. Because like up till now, it's kind of like, my understanding has been a bit of a black box, right? We ask it a question, we get a response back that logically makes relatively decent sense, but we're not sure exactly how the model was able to answer that question in a way that is not nonsensical. I guess, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A bit of double negative, but you get the idea.
Yeah, it kind of gives you a view into how the model is constructing its like assistant personality too, right? Because it's going and grabbing abstract concepts based on the prompts you feed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only able to get like 60% of the way through with the compute they had available, the model. So you could scale this up with more compute power.
Yeah. If you can get the GPUs.
If you can get the GPUs.
That's cool. Yeah, like you said, a meaty article, but if you definitely want to dive into sort of some of the underlying I'll just call it bits and pieces, right? This would be something that would at least kind of shed some light on some things that up until this point were less understood.
Yeah.
Less well understood, maybe. Perfect. Right. And then we got one, I think one more. This is another one that you added. It's only 153 pages, so I expect that you read it all before joining. Give us the scoop on this one.
The only page, a little light reading.
Yeah.
Over the break. The really interesting page was page 43.
Okay.
Which is number section 7. Okay. And this is this article is called Gemini 1.5 Unlocking Multimodal Understanding Across What's the rest of the title? Well, anyways, it's their report on multimodal features in their AI models. And what I thought was really interesting was in this part seven, advanced mathematical reasoning, what they say is that they wanted to try and replicate how in certain domains, if you stop and think about a problem harder or for longer, that actually leads to better results. So they talk about mathematicians as an example, probably physicists too, and hard science theoretical domains benefit from this. So they tested running the same model just with a longer think time, essentially, and it results in improved results. So you get better performance with longer think time. So it's kind of interesting because it's yet another dimension you can scale how good these models are on, right? Because before you had amount of compute, basically, that was the main thing. And now you can also kind of scale amount of compute and then widen that with compute time. And you can expect to see some kind of performance benefit. If that holds true for like larger systems, that's one way to get more intelligence out of the system instead of just scaling up massively with GPUs.
Yeah. It'd be interesting. So if I'm understanding you correctly, basically, if I give the machine, I'll call it the machine, if I give the machine more time to think about it, the quality of the answer that I'm getting back is going to be better.
It
Is
goes
that
up,
it in a nutshell?
in a nutshell.
Yeah, which is really not surprising when you think about it. No different
No.
than the way human brains work. Travers, I need this. You have 5 minutes. I'm going to get 5 minutes worth of time to think up. Oh, actually, I'm going to probably get 2.5 minutes of thinking time and 2.5 minutes of doing time versus you got 2 weeks to do it kind of thing, right? So you got an
Exactly.
opportunity to do that deep thinking, that the hard work part, sort of getting it rationalized in your own brain before answering. So I'm not surprised. I wish you had sent this to me last night though, because I did need something else to procrastinate with. I bet you I could have made it through
You
most
could
of
have
this.
had a great time procrastinating. You could procrastinate for weeks with this paper.
Yeah. So very good. Yeah, that's neat. Any other big takeaways on this one?
Yeah, it's just kind of interesting. You can because you can get there's also the statistical aspect, right? So you can sometimes you might get an anomalous response, but if you have the opportunity to generate a response multiple times, you can kind of pick out the best one. So I'm wondering if that might be at play here as well. Like you get better selection of responses, better quality overall.
You know, it's not related to this, but you just sort of triggered something in my own mind. We've talked a lot about prompt engineering, and you know, I keep reading about it and stuff like that, and I keep going back to that Ethan Mollick book. I'm sort of slugging away at it still. I read it in bits and pieces, kind of the same as the LA summit there. I just keep consuming it in 15-minute chunks kind of thing. But I came across a section in that book where he was giving some sample prompts for things. And it's so funny, like, it's so funny how you don't think of it, but you see somebody else's perspective and you're like, oh, that's so obvious. Why didn't I think of that? And he was giving examples of some prompts that they were using again for, I don't remember what it was, but it was kind of like they were being very specific to say, I want you to do X. I need three responses. None of those responses should be similar. None of those responses should be duplicates. And they were talking about how if I just said to it, I need three of these, the ideas that it would give back to you wouldn't be duplicates, but they would be, in some cases, very, very similar.
Pretty
But
similar,
if
yeah.
you just adjusted your prompt a little bit and were very specific that there are to be no duplicates and your ideas should not be similar, the quality of the response, I'm banging the mic here, the quality of the response that you got back was significantly better. And I tried it. I changed my little Python script that I used to run through the podcast transcript that I'll give it
The
after the
transcripts,
show.
yep.
Yeah, and I just did it off of the old transcript. I ran the first one and I asked it to generate three social posts. And generally, they're good, but I can kind of, in hindsight, when I look back on it, I'm like, yeah, they're kind of almost always very, very similar. So I changed the prompt a little bit and I specifically said, make them unique, no duplicates. And there
Three
was,
different.
yeah, you know, obviously the evidence isn't like a paper like this, it's more anecdotal. But when you looked at it the second time, I was like, yeah, I could see how those are more unique than maybe the previous one where the prompt was a little less concise, where I left it open to maybe too much interpretation.
Right. And that makes, I mean, that's just more useful for what you're going for there, which is unique, interesting social prompts or posts.
Yeah. You know how I kind of slagged prompt engineering over the last little while? I'm doing a lot of fence sitting on this, right? Because as I was building the stuff out, I'm like, oh, I'll ask ChatGPT to generate the prompt for me.
Right.
And you know, okay. I just thought of something. So I'm building out another slide for a different presentation. I'll show you this next week. I'll pull up the conversation. Okay. Oh my God, I was pulling my hair out. I was trying to get it to generate an image. Okay.
Oh no.
Of a fire-breathing dragon protecting its chest of gold coins against a knight. And I could not get it to work, right? It basically was always the dragon was like breathing fire on its chest of coins instead of the knight. And I got to a point where I was like, okay, why don't you generate the prompt that describes what I want? And it gave me a really good prompt. It still sucked. It didn't work. So what do you call that? You call it, there's where you don't give it context as zero shot. Is that zero what it's called? Yeah. So I was like, I'm going to give it something. And I went and I found an image. I won't say what image it was, but you can think of a very popular movie that includes...
Legally obtained image license.
Of course. Yeah. Right. It contains some jewelry and an epic quest and dragons and stuff.
Little guy.
Yeah. Big feet. Those kinds of things. And I gave it one of the images of a dragon.
Okay.
And I gave it a pretty crappy prompt along with the image, and it did exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
Perfect. One shot, but I gave it context. I think that's so important, right? So I keep waffling on the engineering thing.
It's the only way to interact with these models, right? Is how you can optimize. What you can optimize is your prompt, the compute, and the compute time.
Yeah.
And you don't have control over the compute and the compute time, generally speaking.
No,
Unless you're self-hosting. So
you download that model that we were talking about earlier on and run it on your own machine. But
on your 4090 or whatever.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, that is the show. Do you have any housekeeping items?
I don't. We just did the webinar, so that
just
was the
main one. Webinar. Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to come up with a quick housekeeping item before and I couldn't think of one. I don't know what else to talk about.
Well, if you want some light reading, you maybe check out the newsletter.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, plug the newsletter.
Throw a link to this Google article in there. And
you can read it when you're you're supposed to be making slides. You could read this instead. There you go. Yeah. Okay, so let's wrap up with movies. I'll let you go first.
Oh, okay. So we watched, I think there was a new Planet of the Apes movie that came out recently. So we rewatched the original and it still holds up as a sci-fi movie. I think the costumes are and makeup are a little dated, but I mean, it's from the 60s.
Yeah. Is that Charlton
Heston? Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. He's he's the kind of lead guy in it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very good.
And then we watched a fun, it was fun. It was an interesting indie movie, I think from New Zealand, called Time Addicts.
Yep.
And it is a time travel movie about crack addicts. And it's like, they take drugs and it time travels them. But they're just like crappy people time traveling.
Yeah. Nice.
So they have to kind of figure out what's going on. It was good.
That's like, good. You when I saw Time Addicts here, it immediately made me think of a really, really old movie. It's called Time Bandits, and they're like on a pirate ship that goes through time.
Yeah.
I'm going to go find that. It's got to be somewhere. I'm going to watch it this weekend.
Classic.
Yeah, what a great movie. Okay, so I've got a couple movie recommendations as well. Much more mainstream than both of yours. We watched Atlas, J-Lo on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
We both really liked it. It was
okay.
It was a good movie. I want you to watch it. I'm not going to say anything else, but I want you to watch it because there were multiple times it's kind of like they've taken concepts from a whole bunch of other decent sci-fi movies and just squished them together and made something new. There are multiple times, both Karen and I, when we were watching, I'm like, wait, that's like from that movie. And then she was like, wait, that's like from that movie. So it's worth a watch. We both enjoyed it. I want you guys to watch it and tell me if you had sort of those deja vu moments as well, where you're like, wait a second. yeah. So that's the first one. And then we watched Rebel Moon Part 2, also on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think Rebel Moon, both parts, got pretty garbage reviews. That's my recollection of it. I like them both. The one thing I would suggest is that you probably watch Part 1 again before you do Part 2, because they give you like the little 2-minute recap. But I want to say like Part 1 came out like 2 years ago or something. And it feels like a long time ago. And it was hard to kind of tie some of the things together. But I enjoyed it. I think it's worth a watch.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll check those out for sure.
Perfect. And now I'm going to go watch Time Bandits.
Excellent. Perfect. That's one of my favorite movies. That's a good one.
Oh, such a good movie. I watched that when I was a kid. Like, did you pull that up on IMDb?
Time Bandits?
Yeah.
No, I can. But...
okay. Pull it up quickly before we end. I want to know when that actually was released.
81.
81. I don't want to do the math on that. I was nine. I was nine. Was I? Yeah, I was nine. What a great movie. That's got to be on a streaming service somewhere. I'd pay for that movie again. I'd give them $5 for that movie to watch it again. Yeah, so
it's got to be somewhere. Yeah.
I don't think I'd be able to watch. I don't think I'd be able to convince Karen to watch it. I think she'd look at it for 5 minutes and go, I'm not watching this. It looks like it's from the 80s. And I'll be like, that's because it is. Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, man. Awesome.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, that's another episode in the books. It's, what did I say? Episode 23?
23.
23. We're getting up there. That's so right. Enjoy the rest of your week. And we will be back next week on Thursday again, Thursday afternoons. Trying to do the summer Friday thing. So Thursday afternoon instead, with all the interesting AWS and Gen AI news Thursday afternoon, next Thursday afternoon. So we'll see you then.
All right. See ya.
Bye.